Frontier.
Ladies and gentlemen, the following podcast is Wrestling Death and is scheduled for 1 hour. Maybe more. It has no real time limits making their way into your ears. First, from a place called Garniston, he is the Pyramid.
Margaret, a fiend coming out. You stick on, stick that big red light bulb on for a fiend.
And his partner, Fader Top End of Stevenson.
Honky Tonk Man's going to take the bump for this. He's going to bump for it. I'ma take the bump for you. I'ma take the bump for you.
Hello and welcome to Wrestling Daft. My name is Rab Florence, coming here from my living room in the beautiful town of Helensburgh on the west coast of Scotland. And I'm joined by the one and only Mr. Grado.
Who's in a drossing, baby, right next to where you get the boat to Erin, you motherfucker.
Where you been up to, Grado?
Well, I just read the news, breaking news coming out of the Comedy Universe in Scotland, the Royal, what is it, the RTS? What does that stand for?
Royal Television Society.
Right, it's going to hoity-toity one. So there's, for the comedy section, I'll just read you the list of the nominees.
Mm-hmm.
The list of nominees are, Two Doors Down, I was in that.
Starring Grado.
Scott Squad, I'm in that.
Starring Grado.
And then the third one, Burnison.
Burnison with me in it. The difference obviously being that I also wrote Burnison as well.
Well, as make up my lines and all that when I'm doing Scott Squad or something like that.
But you don't make up your lines when you're doing Two Doors Down, mate.
I don't want it. They asked me. I was like, no. Too much on. I'm in TNA this week.
Hold on a minute, though. I've got a question about this. You've not made an episode of Burnison in how long, Rab?
he was on it in a year or some shit. It was just
at the start of last year.
So then, if he wins, then that is totally undeserved because he's only done one show. I've done, if you think about it, 6 episodes of Two Doors Down, the 6 episodes of Scott Squad, that's 12. So if he walks out just for putting out one show,
a
fucking barley in the street, mate.
But Grado, think it this way, right? Think it this way. You go back in the day, right? And you could easily see that Van Hammer for WCW, right? Could wrestle every night for a week, right? And Ric Flair just wrestles on the Friday night. Got to be Ric Flair that wins awards, you know what I mean?
You put it like that, mate. Who do you think's a better wrestler? I mean, Van Hammer.
You're a better wrestler, mate. Don't you put yourself down as a wrestler, by the way.
All right, I thought you said, don't put yourself down as a wrestler, as in, you know, if it asks me a question about a paper, don't write wrestler.
Let's move on, boys. We get some correspondence for last episode. Now, Ian has pointed out that, just Ian, we don't have his surname. Ian points out that Vince Russo, I nearly said Vince Russell there, Big Vinnie Russell, for up there. Ian points out that Vince Russo and Jerry Adams look pretty much the same these days. I'll need to check that out.
I've got a picture right up here.
Vince Russo and Jerry Adams.
No comment.
We should get a balaclava on Vince Russo, see how he looks. Chris on Twitter asked, given that Piers Morgan seems to be having a face turn after being a heel for so long, right? Maybe a good topic is celebrities or personalities who turn face or heel. This is about
Jade Goody's a perfect example. She went from face to heel to face. She had 3 turns.
Yeah.
Because she was a face in Big Brother, then when she returned to Big Brother, she was racist to the woman on Big Brother, and then on and then she became a face just as she was about to die.
Yeah, that's true. She did.
That's the perfect face to heel turn ratio in UK entertainment history.
Now wait a minute, brother. We could argue that she was heel originally when she was on Big Brother because everybody was like,
because she got booed in an intro because she's like, oh my god,
yep. So she went kind of heel face,
but she had 4 turns. Fucking hell, I don't know. I don't know if anybody can beat, if there's anybody out there that can beat Jade Goody's face to heel run.
Well, let's see what the punters say. Rich, Rich says, Pierre still feels like the guy who they're pushing because that's the way Vince thinks it should go. And see, they're just booking somebody who's had these views for decades. It's totally overthought. I love that. Rich is the listener of the week because I love that part.
I like that because that way you think ITV, let's give Pierre's a push. This is
aye, awesome. We're going to push Pierre's now. We're going to push Pierre's now. Pierre's is the face ITV for...
For what, man? For them, man.
You know,
what they need today, what they need to do, sorry, just point you out, but probably another guy who's had a couple of heel and face turns. My hero, who I spoke to through the week, is getting all right. He was on the telly this morning looking good. Michael Barrymore.
Michael Barrymore has definitely had, Bill, let's see, has he...
Original baby face.
He was a face. He's a big, big baby face, right? Who is Michael Barrymore? Like, you know what I mean? Babyface wise, try to think who you would have been.
Hogan. I would say Hogan.
Aye, maybe Hogan, aye. Kids loved him.
British Saturday Night TV.
Kids loved him, grannies loved him and all that. So Barrymore could be as Hogan-esque. Definitely
aye,
Hogan-esque.
I think actually, in fact, you know what? Michael Barrymore has probably had more heel face turns than the fucking Big Show.
But has he though? Has he not just went face to kind of controversial tweener?
I'd say he's maybe a tweener, but it's just because a couple of weeks ago he was on GMTV and it was obviously going, you know, I ain't a wrongin'. Don't listen to Twitter, the Twitterati, don't listen to Twitter Street and all that. And then he got a bit of abuse about it. But apparently Stephanie told me he was on this morning looking well, probably because I spoke to him through the week. I've probably G'd him up.
Well, he was playing the Strike at Lucky board game, mate, on GMTV this morning. Yep.
He was, well, hold on, let me play a clip.
This is a message from Paul Shaw. I know you're a big fan. Well, and Grado asked me if I would send you a message, and apparently you sit, both of you, having a drink and watching Strike Your Lucky. I can't think of a better recipe to spend the night. Good luck to you, lads. Nice to see you. See you, Paul. All the best.
See, I thought he was going to end up saying nice to see you, nice, and I was thinking, oh, that's Bruce's.
Aye. It's difficult to say he's a heel. I suppose to some people he would be a heel.
I want to keep my connection with Maribor. There's things I could say, but I'm not going
to. You don't want to burn the bridges, mate, because you never know. You never know, mate. You might need Barrymore one day. So, as I was saying, the punters have keep it coming in. David says, the Lassie Aff Countdown, who turned out to be a bit of an arsehole.
Out of Alderman, or was that the blonde one?
The blonde Lassie. She's kind of has turned out to be a bit of a sore head. Right. Do you know what I mean?
What, did she get
I don't know if she was a face, though, was she?
Aye.
No, people fancied her.
Aye, people fancied her.
Doesn't aye. Necessarily mean she's a face.
Nah.
Mark Ray says Jade Goody. There you go.
There we go.
The racist chav to People's Princess. See, also Cheryl Tweedy resurrected as Cheryl Cole because obviously she punched a black lassie in the toilets, remember?
All right, aye, that's right. So she's kind of like Big Kevin Thorne, who was originally, you know... You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, oh, I do know what you're talking about. He was called
Miscellaneous or something like that, or Mascaris or Medina.
Oh, man, I need to find this. Anyway, what were you saying? What were you saying about him?
No, I was just saying how, you know, that's what Cheryl Coast went down that route, you know, changing her name, changing her gimmick up a wee bit.
Mordecai.
I was close with Medius.
Mordecai. Mordecai. Ewan McLaughlin says, Paul Gaza Gascoigne, mere face heel turns in the Big Show.
That depends. That, I mean, I've already made that comment. But,
so let's say when he played for England, to me, he was a heel, right? And then when he came to Rangers, he was a mega heel. And then when he did some things in his personal life, he was a heel, even the maximum heel. And then I suppose he was slightly a face when he brought that chicken to Raoul Moat.
Yeah.
That was quite compassionate, I suppose, to try and help
and
that guy out.
Rod. Don't forget the fishing rod.
The fishing rod.
Because he saved that guy's life, unfortunately, the blue sea death before guys get to get him.
Guy Incognito says, Robert Downey Jr. had a great face turn after getting himself sober and making his career come back in the early 2000s. True, but this is just suggesting that a person who has addiction issues is necessarily a heel, which I don't think is necessarily the case. I would say Robert Downey Jr. has always been a face. I wouldn't say he's been a heel, ever.
I'm not really aware of his work.
Robert, a fucking Iron Man.
Oh, come on, you know I don't watch that shit. I lasted half an hour that last week on that Disney Plus. So unbelievable.
Says the wrestler, man. Says the wrestler. David Fleming says, Rod Stewart, could they na-rang and sell like supporters' minds a few months back? Then he says, one, congratulations to Boris Johnson and he's new heel.
You see, Rod Stewart was originally pictured in the Rangers tap back in the day.
Nah, it was just kidding on. No, it was just for Halloween. Who does Rangers have? See, to be fair, who does Rangers have? They have Grado.
Stone Cold Steve Austin, Grado, Shell Suit, Bobby Joe.
Nah, no Stone Cold. They don't have Stone Cold.
There's Steve a picture Austin. Of Stone Cold where Rangers tap.
No, but that was just because...
And when I met him, I was talking to him about the night. He was going, how's the Rangers getting on? I said, I'll get there.
Scott M says Jimmy Savile bigger than Hogan's at the Bash. Now there you go, there's a fucking heel turn. Hey, fucking Rolf Harris.
Aye man, he was a major babyface until
Rolf Harris was a blue eye babyface.
I'll give you one. Fred the Weatherman.
Oh my god, Fred the Weatherman's a belter. Now he was a face.
Yeah,
he was a big babyface.
You know, I've told the story somewhere before, ain't I, about Dean Sullivan and Fred the Weatherman, right?
No.
Oh my God! So me and Jimmy Corkill were hanging about with each other in Liverpool.
Hold on, you and Jimmy Corkill?
Yeah. Right. Me, Jessler Dallas, and Jimmy Corkill. First of all, like walking through Liverpool with Jimmy Corkill was like walking through like New York with Justin Bieber. Right, that's what it was like. Everybody was coming out super drug, but they were boozers. Yeah, right. We was sat in this wee boozer just after the Clyde or whatever that is, they call that their Clyde. And drinking with Moddy and I was like, hey, that's where Fred the Weatherman used to do this morning and jump the maps. And I started nudging, going, hey, do you ever get mad with it one night and jump the map with him and get wrecked with him, you two scout celebrities? And he was like, yeah. You get dead uncomfortable. 5 minutes later, he phoned a taxi and fucked off. And I was like, I've just something rang there. So we get on the caravan to drive to the next fucking, I wasn't driving, to drive to the next town. And I text my mum saying, Mum, I've been hanging about with Jimmy Corkill, Dean Sullivan all day. And she texts me back saying, he's gay. I was like, I didn't know he was gay. So I Googled Dean Sullivan, Jimmy Corkill, and it came up. Jimmy Corkill had been in a 10-year relationship with Fred Talbot, the weatherman.
What?
They were lovers.
Jimmy Corkill.
Aye,
Jimmy Crackill.
Yeah, down there, Uzzy.
Jimmy Crackill.
Jimmy Trainees, I need to go get it, Uzzy.
Jimmy Crackill.
Jimmy Crackill.
So there Jimmy Crackill. 10-year relationship
Fred's
with it, mate. Jimmy Crackill.
The person that had to grasp like Fred in, or, you know, tell him, like well, then who what happened? You know, who is it that abused you? Well, you know that guy that used to, you know, jump the maps on this morning, and the policeman just going, what, Fred the Weatherman? And maybe like popping, I don't know.
Yeah, but like Fred the Weatherman, the guy that used to go out with Jimmy Cackle. Right, so Ian's contributed to our ongoing topic of Family Members Day wrestling catchphrases as his 6-year-old son, Liam, does this.
Grado, it's yourself.
Oh, Grado, it's yourself. That's cute. Merle Grado versus Alexa Saga here, though, Grado.
All right, okay.
Sean gave it a go.
Computer, who is Grado?
Grado is a fictional character in the Star Wars franchise.
Grado?
That's about right.
Jabba the Hutt?
That's about right, did they say?
Oh my God, I need to phone Vivian now, man. Right, I'm just going to just voice message my agent to get
what, to get Alexa sorted out?
Yep.
We reckon David has nailed it, though, Grado.
Just like, you know, I'm having a wee bit of bother with Alexa. You used to be able to say who it is, Grado, and it tell you. Now it tells people I'm either Jabba the Hutt for Star Wars or a German Nazi. If you can try and sort that out.
But David has got in touch, and we think he's maybe nailed it, mate.
Oh.
So, we hear this.
Right, what do you hear? Right.
Open Grado Facts.
Welcome to Grado Facts. Let's start. Grado won the Pro Wrestling Elite Heavyweight Championship from Dave Mastiff at Grado Mania.
Yes.
Working for TNA on the Wrestling Daft podcast.
What was that saying, that?
Grado has never mentioned working for TNA on the Wrestling Daft podcast.
If you guys or ladies want to get in touch with us about any of that or just random wrestling related stuff, get us on Twitter at Wrestling Daft, on Instagram at Wrestling Daft Podcast, or just Wrestling Daft on Facebook, or email wrestlingdaft@gmail.com. Now every week we like to separate the good for the bad in wrestling. The aliens from the Alien 3. Aliens is good, Alien 3 being bad. There. Yeah, agree with that, Grado? Do you, have you watched Alien?
Is that the one where that big geck and a Jewish fella's in it? No, it's the Fly.
What? What?
I'm thinking of the Fly, you know?
The big Jewish fella.
I might watch that.
Who do you want to bury in?
Goldberg or something, I don't know.
Jeff Goldblum.
Ah, that's it.
Who do you want to bury and who do you want to put over?
Mate, I've been working my ass off. I've been doing my frontline work, my radio work. I don't even know if I've even seen a wrestling fucking picture this week, never mind a show or...
I'm going to put over John Cena, basically. I'm going to do that because he's still out there doing his Make-A-Wish stuff, even with the pandemic going.
Aye, I seen that.
I don't even want to go to the Co for my messages. And the bold John Cena still cutting about the country, going and making these wee Wayne's wishes come through. He's...
Should he be doing that, but in this current climate?
Ach, aye.
I might borrow him for that. Cause that's
I'm sure it's safe. And what a guy. I mean, what a guy he is.
Mr. Kennedy telling me his breath smells like shite.
Whose breath smells like shite?
Apparently Cena's.
I'm not fucking having that. I'm not having that. I'm not having you saying that on my fucking podcast show.
I mean, I love Cena, but apparently that was the word on the street.
I'm moving on for that. I want to see what the punters are saying. I'm putting over John Cena, and who am I burying? I'm not going to bury anybody. I'm going to bury anybody. I'm not in the mood to bury anybody.
Back. Come on, let's just do it.
No, I'm not going to bury anybody. I'm not going to bury anybody. Yeah, John, however, one of your listeners, wants to put over the Liv Morgan match with Charlotte. Did you see the Liv and Charlotte match, Grado? I know you like to keep up with a woman's wrestling.
I never saw the Liv and Charlotte Church match. Charlotte Church. Is that not the Welsh singer?
He's saying Charlotte. Listen, it's a mistake in the show notes, right? That producer John has written Charlotte Church in the show notes.
That's not a mistake because Grado once referred to.
Yeah, it's a reference. It's a reference to your mistake.
Oh, Grado. When did I say that?
Fucking 4 weeks ago or something, you called Charlotte Church. Anyway, Liv Morgan and Charlotte Church. I've not seen that match myself. I'll need to check that out. Liv is... I would like to see them day with Liv Morgan because she's got a lot of personality. But John wants to bury just the fact that wrestling's shite with no fans. Well, there's not much they can do about that, is there? Really?
Hazy's putting over the Revolts podcast with Jericho. Worth a listen. I spoke to Jericho at the weekend, a wee bit of FaceTiming. That's what I was going to say, I couldn't say, but I just wanted to let you know that's what I was doing. I get...
a wee catch-up with the Bulgin.
No, it was good fun, man. So it was. But,
is he all right? Is he doing okay?
I can't tell you, man. You know what I'm saying? It's between me and him.
Is it just for the boys, Grado?
He can't. Nobody's allowed to. It's wrestlers only. Cool wrestlers.
Okay. Hazy wants to bury the picture I drew on the Money in the Bank poster. For fuck's sake, he looks like a geek. Right? I need to see this.
Come on. I need to see it.
Let's see this Money in the Bank. This is me typing. Can you hear it?
I'm doing the same thing as well, but
man,
I've got a MacBook. So.
Look at his happy smile. Look at his big happy smile. He's got a big happy smile. So is that why we're saying he looks like a geek? Because he's really just very happy? That's weird though, isn't it? It's weird that they've got him smiling like that.
I've never even seen Drew smile like that in real life.
See the face that Drew's making on that Money in the Bank poster, that big smile? That's the face all the Celtic fans make when Steven Gerrard says he's staying at Rangers.
I'll just see you at the RTS Awards and we'll see who's fucking smiling that night, right? Handicap match. Two doors down is Scott Squad versus Burnison. Come on.
Come on, boys.
Yeah, fucking break. I tell you what, if you fucking win this, I'm going to, honestly, if you win it, I'm coming up and taking the fucking wee man on a stick and shoving it right up your shifter.
It's not a man on a stick. It's actually just a glass column. And I've got a pretty big sphincter, but a glass column wouldn't fit up it. No. I've tried. I'm talking for experience. Sean is burying Raw until it goes back to 2 hours. Watched it the other night and felt like it was never going to end, he says. And he wants to put over Ahmed Johnson. I don't know what he's up to these days, he says, but I just thought he was class.
Ah, that's quite a nice comment.
That is a nice
Have you ever seen like some shoot interviews with him and he'll question the presenter and go, How do you know that? How do you know that? Who told you that? Who told you that? You ever watched something?
Did he do that?
Takes Hammer in the wrong way. Who told you that? When the fuck do you read that? He's fucking great quality for an
intimidating.
Let me get him on and bam him up.
Aye. Sandy wants to put over Lashley getting a decent push again. It's been wasted and it's no great to see he's been booked like the unit he is.
Don't send bad him to my friend Bobby. He's my good mate. He's a good mate of mine.
I feel like they've no ever really found how to present Bobby Lashley.
Aye.
And he wants to bury Humberto Carrillo. Honestly, do not see the hype around him, and more deserving people deserve that spot over him.
What do you think they should do with Lashley? Lashley should be with Lesnar at one point, right?
Bro, you want to see that, didn't you? You know me. You talk, like, Grado, who, look who you're talking to here. You know I want, if there's big guys.
The damaged goods, but...
Who?
Lashley, in terms of being in fucking Daft Storylines or that ticket, Leo Rush, whatever.
No, because you know it only takes a couple of months to turn somebody around.
True.
And particularly when you look like that, when you're a big, giant, physical specimen, then all you need to do is set a guy like that loose on people for a few months and you're laughing. Stephen wants to put over Cena for his Make-A-Wish appearances. Yes. Bury the fact that AEW is throwing Marco Stunt about like a ragdoll against massive guys.
So Sammy Callahan pulled me up a couple of years ago and says there's the guy going about stealing your gimmick with a bum bag and he does a whole Rock entrance. I've never really been exposed to Marco Stunt. I've only heard him ever getting buried on the Jim Cornette podcast. He follows me on Twitter. I suppose I'm just a jealous bastard of him. He's a job in Abno.
Listen, Marco Stunt will love getting flung about like a ragdoll against massive guys. So don't worry about Marco Stunt. He's fine. Scott wants to put over Liv Morgan and Selena Vega, both class again this week, and actually making Raw enjoyable. But wants to bury folk that keep saying WWE are burying wrestlers after a loss. Well, see, for me, bring back the jobbers, man. Like, one of the main things I would do if I was running a wrestling show is I would have your stars going over just some jobbers.
Listen, do you know what? It's funny you say that. I kind of made a cunt here. But that's what I want. You know, I always feel that the first match in a show should be something like a big, fat, muscly, fucking monster. I couldn't come out and just weigh somebody in 10 seconds, and that's the opening match.
Well, there you go.
But I never ever do it. And I always, when I book creator, he ends up fucking putting the other cunt over, which is, I really need to stop doing. I need to give him a push.
Grado, what is the deal with creator? Because I've only ever seen him wrestle. He was in World of Sport, right?
Aye.
He wrestles in World of Sport and then he wrestles in your Pavilion shows. But he's no... I kind of feel confused about the guy. How much does he work?
Well, first of all, he was given that gimmick, right? But here's the truth. He was meant to be originally called, instead of Creator, he was meant to be called Stench. Which I think is fucking brilliant. And when all the boys found out he was going to be called Stench, we went, that's perfect, but he didn't want to do it. He wanted to be called something else, so they gave him Creator. So the boys all call him Stench.
So the boys still call him Stench?
Well, it's maybe kind of died in a wee bit, but at the time we just required him. How great a name is that for somebody that looks like that? He looks like a Stench, doesn't he? You know, Hank?
Well, I suppose he looks more like a Stench than he looks like a Creator. Because a crater's a big hole. This is what I've never understood. Why is he called a big hole? Fraser say wants to put over Jimmy Havoc and Kip Sabian getting more TV time in AEW. If it was business as usual, I could see them easily being lost in the shuffle. Also put over the Manitoba Melee as the best of the bubbly bunch so far. Again, no. This is all fucking Greek to me, AEW. Again, no real buddies. But wondering if they're going to explain AJ's return or if it's just a case of, as wrestling, do we need to explain?
Is that AJ Styles or is it Punk's Bud?
No, AJ Styles. You don't need to explain it. We all know that AJ Styles didn't actually fucking die and get buried.
No, he's...
Jesus fucking Christ. You imagine anything worse than AJ Styles turning up and going, so I dug myself out and I came back to life and fuck off. Scott put over last week's episode was one of the best so far. It was one of the best so far, but he wants to bury Grado's shite broadband.
I agree with that, but looking at this other cunt called Dylan, I'm burying Grado for complaining that there are no audiences. Mate, this is clear admission. You're not supporting your pals, Colt and Jericho, as AEW is a small audience around the Ring of Talent that fixes the awkward silence. Listen,
doesn't it count?
I fucking said that the Colt would probably work. Actually, FaceTime Colt on Monday, and I says, "Do you know what?" I says, "This is actually perfect for you because you're a he's a bit like me. Like, you're better off seeing me live than watching me back on YouTube. You get what I mean? So you can hear all the funny wee bits and bobs that come out my mouth. And Colt Cabana is the same. So I think this is a perfect time for Colt to be in the situation that he's in." And I said that to him on Monday, and he just nodded his head.
Just don't worry about it. This guy should not be coming on here and moaning at you and saying that AEW has an audience around the ring. Dylan wants to put over, however, the Spanish god Sammy Guevara.
Yeah, that said connection unstable there.
The guy's like a young Mr. Perfect in that he backs up his arrogance every single week.
Spanish I'm so god. Sorry for my Dylan. Multi-millionaire pals. I'm so sorry for all my pals that are running about in mansions and fucking HRVs. That's a fucking thing, man.
Dylan is an AEW mark. That's what he is. He's a mark.
Pals have some of the best lives you can ever live. There's some people for the boatman to Stevenson that kind of that fucking wear Adidas two stripe. Yeah, this cunt's complaining that because my pals Colt and Jericho, who are sitting in their mansions with their millions, and I'm sitting here listening with a fucking bottle of Strongbow.
Grado is ordering for the fucking Spicy Hut 4 times a week, keeping that fucking business running. What are you fucking doing, Dylan? Grado is keeping the fucking Spicy Hut, keeping that fucking light zone in that building. What are you, Dylan? You worry about putting money in the pockets of Chris Jericho and leave fucking Grado to worry about putting money in the pockets of the real fucking people. That's the people that work in the fucking Spicy Hut in Stevenson. This podcast is sponsored by Spicy Hut.
Cheers, Rob.
Chris Grant, you like this one, Grado? Chris Grant is putting over fuck all and he's burying everything. Fucking scun up.
That's my lesson of the week. It's now time to talk about our Patreon. As lockdown continues, it's time to get more content from Wrestling Daft by signing up to Patreon. Patreon.com/...
Nay backslashes. Yeah. Make sure you make it clear to them there's no backslashes allowed.
It's quite a pause in the segue there. Wrestling Daft. Hello to some of the new patrons. Shout out to Stephen Roche, who's upgraded his account. Well done, mate. We've set up 3 tiers which you can choose to get involved in at patreon.com/wrestlingdaft. Tier 1, you're the Cruiserweight Champion, which is about £3 a month. On that, you get the patron only chat community, so you can all talk amongst yourselves about how gallus and sexy we are. You get ad-free versions of all episodes, you get full unedited version, you get random bonus content, and you get the video version of the Marks podcast. And then you can also vote to what you want to see on the list of Wrestling Daft. Tier 2, you want to be the Intercontinental Champion, that's about £7.70, $10 a month. You get the video version of the podcast each month. It's the same as all the stuff that you get in the first tier, or tier, however you pronounce it. You get a bonus episode once a month. Next one's going to be next week, possibly joining me. So if you want to hear my life story, you know, this is my life. This is my life with John McAnally, then buy that tier. This weekend, we're going to have one for Money in the Bank, because it must be Money in the Bank on Sunday if I know anything about that. Oh, no, I do know it's Money in the Bank. I spoke to a lot of my pals high up in WWE that told me stuff about it, which I can't review on this podcast. Tier 3, World Heavyweight Champion, which is about $20 a month. That's about £15. You get everything in the previous tiers, as well as free tickets to every live event. They always sell out every time we do live events. Once we're allowed to get out of the self-isolation again. And you get a Wrestling Daft t-shirt, free one of your choice. But you need to sign up for a minimum of 3 months. Don't just fucking think you can pay £20 and get that t-shirt. You need to probably pay £60 for a t-shirt. So there you go. Plus, to feature on one of our shows is one of our marks. So if you fancy that and becoming one of our patrons, sign up now at patreon.com/wrestlingdafts as we would love to welcome you to the roster.
You just made the list!
This week on our Patreon, we ask for you guys to vote on our list of Wrestling Daft. Remember, you can vote by signing up for $4 a month at patreon.com/wrestlingdaft. Now, this week, as it's Money in the Bank, MITBBB, we ask you to choose between your favourite winners and cash-ins and put that up against the most outrageous moments in wrestling. What's it going to be? Favourite winners and cash-ins? Most outrageous moments in wrestling? 65% of you wanted us to talk about the most outrageous moments in wrestling. So here is my top three most outrageous moments in wrestling. My number three is going to be Halloween Havoc 1991, and it's when Abdullah the Butcher got electrocuted in an electric chair.
The crowd here going crazy in the opening moments of Halloween Havoc. Cactus Jack, he thinks Steiner's in there, but it's Abdullah. Cactus Jack thought it was Rick Steiner, but Abdullah, my gosh, think about what he's experiencing. He's getting cooked.
How did you pronounce Abdullah the Butcher?
Like this, Abdullah the Butcher.
No, you said it different. You said it like Abdullah.
Abdullah the Butcher.
You said Abdullah.
Abdullah the Butcher.
You said that as if, like, I don't know, like, you knew him and that's the way he likes getting called it. Abdullah.
Abdullah the Butcher. Get electrocuted in an electric chair. I believe it was Mick Foley, it was Cactus Jack that flicked the switch that electrocuted Abdullah the Butcher. Now, the reason why I chose this as my number three most outrageous moment in wrestling is because I've been trying to think about this in terms of, let's imagine it's somebody that doesn't watch wrestling and they just kind of turn out to the wrestling and seeing this big guy sitting in an electric chair getting electrocuted going like that for me is outrageous. Do you know what I mean? Because we're not, correct me if I'm wrong, we're not talking about things like Bruiser Brody getting fucking stabbed in the dressing room, none of it, right? It's not that kind of stuff. It's like stuff that happens in the ring. So that's my number three.
I've not seen that. I need to see that.
My number two is a moment from Hustle Japan. It's a kind of like an angle in Hustle Japan when the...
What'd you call it? Ruzio.
Just listen to me. When the erotic terrorist Yinling was involved in a... No, the erotic terrorist Yinling was... She was like an erotic model who joined Hustle. And she was like a villainous kind of... She used sex really to control people, right? And she was in a match with the Great Muta. And the Great Muta... Muta took an opportunity at one point in the match to blow his green mist at Yinling's fanny, and it got Yinling pregnant with Great Muta's baby for his green mist.
Fucking brilliant.
And Yinling laid an egg that became this giant egg that a wrestler called Akebono hatched out of. It was this big giant fat wrestler, Akebono, giant Bono, monster Bono. And eventually, ultimately, the story ended in a tragic way because Akebono ended up fighting his mother Yinling in a match and then crushed her to death. So that's my set, number two outrageous moment is Great Muta blowing the green mist at Yinling's crotch and getting her pregnant. And my number one has got to be, because I still to this day can't quite believe that they aired it when you consider the profile of the WWE, but Stone Cold Steve Austin getting crucified by Undertaker still remains for me the most outrageous moment in wrestling.
I've never seen anything like this in my life, Michael Cole. Look at this. Stone Cold Steve Austin is being humbled right now. The Undertaker is making an example of it.
Here's the punters, though. Here's what the punter says. Al B says, Randy and the Cobra, Randy Savage, an incredible moment that's only get better with time when we learn the backstory that Randy got Jake to get the snake to bite him first to prove its venom glands had been removed. You can hear about that story on Jericho's podcast where he interviews Jake the Snake. It's very good, from the Jericho Cruise. Dom says the hand that Mae Young gave birth to being grown up. What the fuck does that mean?
How original.
For how original. Don't listen to Grado's in a bad mood. He's turned heel. We're talking about people turning heel early. He's turned heel. Fraser says New Jack, just New Jack. New Jack. There's nothing outrageous about New Jack. If anything, New Jack is predictable. He's going to come out and he's so wild. He's so dangerous. But Grado has told me a million times that he would knock fuck out a New Jack. Marco says,
say that. Cut that about.
Nah, I need disrespect. I was actually going to
DM him because he's on my Facebook and I was thinking he's just released a book, so maybe why I come on here.
Yeah, that'd be good. Marco says Jeff Jarrett tanking women every week and putting them in a figure four, which led up to a good housekeeping match with China. Yeah, man. Sean, five words, choppy choppy your pee pee. If you remember that, kind tie business with Val Venus. Scott McKenzie, May Young flashing her paps at everybody she could at the Miss Royal Rumble contest. Remember that?
Oh, that was brilliant. I had a fucking offer, Rager.
Fraser says, it's got to be Big Boss Man stealing the coffin at Big Show's dad's funeral. Oh my God, that's good. Or Boss Man feeding Al Snow his end, Doug. Boss Man character was a maniac. A fucking maniac, 1999. Listen, see Boss Man and Big Show's dad's funeral. See that feud, man? I fucking love that. That's hilarious, man.
That was great, wasn't it?
Absolutely brilliant. Big Show owned that coffin and not getting dragged.
Aye. Talk about an emotional guy. See, anytime you ever watch an interview, man, he always starts greeting. See if he gets interviewed after Steve Austin, he always finds something to greet about.
Yeah, for sure.
John.
Dylan says Lucha Underground when they literally started killing characters off. Brian Cage even won an Infinity style gauntlet, Infinity Wars style, the Infinity Gauntlet style thing, and punched a hole right through a guy's head. So many crazy moments in their short run. Everybody should take some time to watch that short-lived series. You watched any Lucha Underground, Grado?
I think I watched one or two episodes, man, but nah, it wasn't for me.
Too cartoonish, too daft.
I mean, I like that the idea of the studio setting and stuff like that, but it was like the wrestling too much for me. Look, but tell you what, there was one fucking great match with Vampiro and some other Lucha guy. That was great. If you'd built up, but we are after it.
It's a classic Vampiro versus some other Lucha guy. It's a belter. It's a five-star classic.
I mean,
Vampiro. Margaret, go on and go out of my tapes and see if you can dig out Vampiro versus some mad Lucha guy for me.
That's good because he's got shaved head and he's wearing street clothes and all that. It's good.
Aye. Yeah, Dale, maybe a bit of a cliche, but for me, it's Undertaker lobbing Mankind off the top of the hill in a cell and disintegrating the announce table. Still to this day makes me sit back and go, wow, Mick Foley is the god of wrestling. WTF moments. No storyline fodder, just pure bodily sacrifice for our entertainment. Yes, legend. Legend, says Dale. Dale's a big Mick Foley fan. I actually feel like that segment is extremely irresponsible, distasteful. And it's fucking brilliant, man. It's brilliant that Hell in a Cell match, isn't it?
I showed my mother not long ago. She went, holy fuck, man. That must have been sore.
That's going to be. That's a fucking sore, isn't it?
That's a close one.
Margaret, what was that cage match? It was a Mick Foley versus Mad Undead Guy. Mad Undead Guy 2000. And, get that. Karate Warrior. Oh, 1998, was it?
Yeah, it was.
King of the Ring, 98.
Aye, mate.
I had it on VHS. I remember the cover in black with the thingies and the red writing. Karate Warrior 2 says Chucky from Child's Play stalking Rick Steiner in WCW. That went on for fucking weeks and months, by the way.
I never saw that.
Chucky. Rick Steiner would be in matches in the ring, you know, and then you would just hear, hey, Rick. You'd hear like fucking Chucky going, hey, Rick, it's me, Chucky.
That sounds fucking brilliant. How have I not seen that?
You need to look
I must have been on the road.
You need to look that up. Anyway, thanks for the contributions, folks. Some amazing highlights there, let me tell you. But you got to look out my picks there. You have to look out that Yuengling and Hustle. And have a wee look at Abdullah Butcher getting his fucking head fried. Now listen, you can go wrestling daft your very self by sporting your very own wrestling daft t-shirt. Get them at shop.spreadshirt.co.uk/wrestlingdaft/backslashes or you'll get slashed. On there you'll find designs such as I'm a Mark, I'm a Take the Bump for you, Chips, Cheese and Donner Meat, and I'm a Wrestler too. Plus, right now, you can get free standard delivery. That is absolutely free. And remember, take a pic so we can enter you into our Hall of Fame, just as Lewis did with his Chips, Cheese and Donner t-shirt in red. So check out our range of t-shirts and hoodies at shop.spreadshirt.co.uk/wrestlingdaft now, or just check out the links on our Facebook page or our Twitter at wrestlingdaft.
Right now, let's introduce the former creative director of on-air promotions at WWE, as well as a producer of TNA and Impact Wrestling. He is the man that brought Vince McMahon to tears, and he now works for MLW. Do you work for MLW? I didn't know that. Do you?
I did before I came back to Impact. I worked with them as the show director.
All right.
They wanted me on board more, but one of my conditions coming back, working for Anthem and working for Impact, was that I had to give up MLW. So I'm exclusive to Impact right now, under contract. Oh.
That's it. And Big Eric Tompkins, he told me to promote Impact Wrestling. Not that I ever really do. I'm always I talk about Impact a lot on this program, Robert.
Occasionally.
Basically, I get ribbed for talking about Impact every week, Sahadi. So that's basically that. you can catch Impact live. No, don't get live, fuck. But it's on every week on Five Star. I think it's a Saturday, so. I mean, I watch it. There's some good stuff going on right now at Impact. What do you think?
I do like the content. And one thing I got to tell you, Grado, is when I left in 2017, before we even get into the content, there was a very negative vibe backstage. Like, Impact the last couple of years under the old regime, it was just not a fun place to work. And then when Scott called me a year ago and asked me to come on back, I said, let me think about that. And I talked to Gail Kim. She was working at Impact at the time. And she said, David, it is a completely different place than the Impact that you left a year ago. Please come back. And I got to tell you, Grado, it's like, I love it. It's such a great co-creative environment where we're working with talent. We're getting ideas from Sammy Callahan. We're getting ideas from Eddie Edwards on how to do things. We're giving them ideas. So the production and the talent interaction is tremendous.
Aye.
Even when it comes to doing packages and shoots and post-production, the vibe there is awesome. It's like a whole new company.
That's good to hear. there was a point, it felt as if as around about as soon as I joined in 2014, everything just went completely downhill.
it started before you joined in 2014. Too bad you weren't around in 2009 and 2010, but it started before you were there. And you were privy to some of the negativity that was there backstage and the backstabbing and how it was not always such a fun place to work and be around. And right now, it really is. I'm glad I jumped back in full time.
David, for our listeners, can you give us just a little capsule review of your career so far up to this point?
Even I want to know this because you know that, David, that Bruce Pritchard mentions you on his podcast every other week. There's people that want to know your story, David, you know?
Okay, if I go too long, you can cut me off. How about that?
Yeah, no, just go for it. Just go for it, man. We get time.
Well, I started working in NBC Sports, and I was at NBC for 4 years. I became, within 4 years, the head of on-air promotion for NBC Sports. And I was the youngest person in any major network to hold that title. And
right, so yeah, what age were you then, David? What age was that?
Oh, I was in my mid-20s. This is back in 1988 to 1992 when I left to go to WWF.
Right.
Now WWE. People want to know what the motivation was. It was twofold. One is that I wasn't creatively satisfied at NBC Sports. They were very conservative, and every time I tried to think outside the box, they would rein me back in. They wanted everything very standard, mention name, day, event, and time. And also, there was a person, John Filippelli, otherwise known as Flip, who was the executive producer at WWF. I had known him from NBC Sports. He was a big-time producer there, and he left to go work for Vince. And he courted me to come to WWF. And at first, I resisted. They made me a offer that was 1.5 times more than I was getting paid at NBC, but I wanted to stay at NBC Sports. They thought I was bluffing. I gave them 8 weeks to make a counteroffer. They refused to make a counteroffer, and I left. But it was the greatest thing that I ever did because
sorry to interrupt, but was that decision purely, was it purely financial, or was it also creative? And was there also a wee element of, because I often think this about the wrestling industry, sometimes it kind of, I think when you get an offer from the wrestling industry, it feels a wee bit like running away with the circus. There's a wee bit of an element of that. What kind of factors were playing into your decision then when you made that jump?
Well, A, it wasn't just financial, because I would have stayed for less than what WWF was offering me.
Yeah.
I felt that I was being taken advantage of because of my age, me being so youthful. And the fact that they didn't think that it was a credible offer, that nobody from sports would leave to go work for a wrestling company.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that I had sports as a background, that's one thing that I brought to wrestling. I tried to do packages and promotions that made the athletes, the stars of wrestling, feel like they were real sports players and real athletes. So I brought a sense of realism at first into the wrestling world. And, you know, one of the spots that I did a couple of years in was called the Attitude Spot. And it begins with, you know, all the wrestlers saying, I know what you're thinking. I'm not really an athlete. I'm just a wrestler. Well, I was an all-star at this. You know, I played football for the Dallas Cowboys. I was legitimizing these great athletes. You know, that people said, oh, there's professional wrestlers. They didn't understand how talented and how
I mean, I think in a lot of people, a lot of wrestling fans look back at the Attitude Era in WWF and really hold it in high regard, really high regard. But for me, because I work in the TV industry, and for me, the reason why the Attitude Era was so exciting was a lot of that was about production. It was about the production of the thing, and you could see that it had taken a big step forward. I mean, the WWF old school, that promo video that you produced, the classy Freddie Blassie and stuff, I mean, that landed unbelievably. It really landed unbelievably. I can remember watching it live myself.
Yes.
And I think it's arguably the best wrestling video package there's ever been, I think.
That's the one that made Vince McMahon cry.
Yeah, I mean, really? But it's really special. It's really special.
You want to hear a great backstory to that?
Yeah.
So we did the Attitude Spot where we legitimized the athletes as being real, you know, athletes, this and that. So the spot with Classy Freddie Blassie, in my mind, was the follow-up. It was the sequel. So I was taking the older guys and having them put over the younger guys. And by this point, working WWF, I had so much creative latitude that I didn't have to run anything by Vince anymore. And Kevin Dunn, the executive producer, knew that I was doing the spot with the older talent, you know, shooting in Albany. And Vince found out the day I was doing the shoot. And he told Kevin, what is Sahadi doing with these older stars? We're all about the new generation right now and these young guys. What's he doing? Kevin Dunn basically told Vince that, don't worry, Sahadi has a good track record. Let's just see what he has to do. So basically, Kevin called me during the shoot and said, Vince knows you're working with the older guys. He does not know what the spot's about. He thinks it's wrong. So it better be good. That's all I got to tell you. Have a good shoot. And he hung up. And when Vince came to the spot, you know, in the room, he had an attitude. He had the old, you know, walk with me. He wouldn't even look at me. We got in the room. He goes, okay, play that spot. And we start playing spot. And about 15 seconds in, he's like, damn. He goes, damn. And once again, he goes, like, damn. And before the spot ends, he walked out of the room. And I turned to Shane, who was there, you know, along with Vince, and said, Shane, what does that mean? And Shane turned to me and smiled. And he goes, you got him, Sahadi. You got him. Now walk out of the studio. And Vince is sitting on the floor crying in tears. He's like, thank you. Thank you so much, David. Thank you so much. So I walk upstairs to tell Kevin Dunn that Vince liked the spot, the one that he was creatively against at first, that I, you know, that I didn't run the idea by him while we were using older guys. And then Kevin's like, good job. So I walk down the hallway 15 minutes later. Vince is still sitting on the stairs with his son and Pat Patterson, and he's crying and he's telling me thank you. And I think the reason why was it was twofold. I think it was very personal for Vince because the spot was a passing of the torch of the older guys to the new guys, the Stone Cold Steve Austin, the Undertakers, you know, all the talent that was there now, The Rock.
Yeah.
But he also saw like how he took what his father had done, because these older guys from his father's era, and how Vince himself had surpassed what his father had even dreamt about. So I think it resonated with him on a very personal level, and that's why it drove him to tears.
I think it was an incredible spot, that, to be honest. Is it your favorite spot, or do you have a spot that you are particularly proud of yourself?
I have many favorite spots. That's my favorite spot in the sense that it drove Vince to tears.
Yeah.
Probably not the most favorite spot I did, but that spot also resonates with me on many levels too, because I became a big Freddie Blassie fan during the end of his career.
Yeah.
And I would use Freddie's voice in a lot of the openings I did for some of the pay-per-views.
Yes, for
Mania. Also, we did a couple of things called Freddie Fellini's, the black and white fun piece we did with Freddie that were like silent movies.
Yep.
And I just had a special bond with Freddie. So that meant a lot for me because, you know, I kind of feel as though giving Freddie things to do every couple of months kind of like made him feel still relevant and still part of the world.
That's nice. That's warm and lovely. No, I was just going to ask you, Sahadi, at that point, so you're working for Vince, what was your schedule that at that time, you know, that during the 90s, early 2000s, in terms of where were you based? Did you need to go on the road? Were you at live events? Were you just TV tapings? What was it? What was your week like?
I was purely based in the studio in Stamford. But I wouldn't have to go to the TVs, Grado, but I would go to the TVs once every 2 months to maybe do an ID shoot with all the wrestlers backstage. I went on the road a lot to shoot the commercials that we would use for our pay-per-views and the cold opens. We would go to L.A. a lot of times and shoot a spot with The Rock, with Brock Lesnar, or go to Miami to shoot spots down there as well. And one thing I like to do in the spots that I shot, Grado, I was inspired by ESPN. At that time, they're doing campaigns, which I call fish out of water. You'd be like in the ESPN offices in Bristol, Connecticut, and you'd see like Roger Clemens dressed as a Yankee making photocopies in the copy machine. They're doing like everyday kind of jobs. Yeah. So I always like to take wrestlers and put them in situations in restaurants, in a hotel, somewhere where they're in their wrestling gear, the fish out of water, yet they're feeling perfectly comfortable and just have a lot of fun with those kind of spots. Because those spots are for people that were not necessarily wrestling fans, who weren't airing during our programming. One thing you always have to realize as somebody who is a creative director is know your audience. A spot that I'm going to play in Raw, you know, you're going to dedicate that toward the wrestling fan. If this spot's going to air outside the box, you want to do outside the box thinking and get people's attention. A lot of the spots I did, you wouldn't even know it was a wrestling spot until you're halfway or two-thirds of the way. Yeah.
Remember the video at Stamford, and it shows those chair shots and somebody coming out an elevator, and I think it winds up on Mick Foley saying to make the world a better place for mankind. Remember that one?
That spot aired in the Super Bowl. That was the first ever Super Bowl spot we did. Now everybody had an agency doing Super Bowl spots, but we were the agency. We created that spot ourselves, wrote that spot ourselves, shot that spot. I directed that spot myself. So we were our own agency who did that spot. And that was just to give people a little ha-ha about wrestling. You know, here you have the Super Bowl audience. You know, a lot of people aren't wrestling fans. And it's like, we want to let them think, hey, you know what? They know how to have fun there at WWE.
Yeah. Did you have a healthy budget, David, to do this stuff?
Oh, yes, we did. The budget for the Super Bowl spot, though, was a fraction of what the agencies were charging. But
yeah.
I basically had a healthy budget to do these commercial spots, which was nice.
How did it work with the pay-per-view songs? Were you providing the songs? How does it work out? The WWF get asked by record companies to play this song for that month, or did you guys pick it? How does that work?
Well, when we weren't popular, we couldn't get anybody to do music for us. But when we became popular and mainstream, it was a co-collaborative thing. If we'd want to use a song, a lot of times we would contact the artist or the label, and it would work vice versa as well too. They would suggest songs to us as well because they knew that we were popular and we were mainstream and all that kind of stuff. I mean, back then we had the college crowd, we had the 30-something crowd, you know, we had everybody that was watching us on Monday nights.
David, you've done a lot of talk about, you know, keeping in mind your audience and who's watching the show. What is your ideal scenario? Like, what is your ideal audience for the kind of packages that you like to produce? What age range are you talking about? What's your comfort zone? Where do you like to operate?
My age range would be anywhere between 17 and 70. Right. And what I'd like to do in those spots is just do stuff that was wildly outlandish and creative. All my favorite spots were ones that were outside the box thinking, just completely, you know, a ha-ha or something. You know, let me go back a little bit on this. This will answer your question. But when I first came to WWF, back in 1992, Vince McMahon said to me, we were at an event in Regina, Canada, he said, David, what we do here is all about emotion. Now, guys, he was talking about, you know, the characters, baby faces and heels, and the storylines that were being told in the ring. But I took that all about emotion to the work that I was doing. So every spot that I would conceive of and write and go out there and shoot, I would want to evoke some kind of emotion in the viewer that was seeing that, whether it was, you know, complete like anger or desperation or joy, or maybe get them to think about something in their lives or resonate with something that's happened to them personally. I always try to connect with the viewer on an emotional level. So yeah. I try to use emotion and an array of emotions in every single spot that I did.
That's interesting.
And have you always been very hands-on with the edit of this stuff as well? Would you always be right there? Yeah.
Yeah. By hands-on, well, basically, I would come up with the ideas, and I would run them by Vince, and, you know, most times he would say yes. So then if it's my idea, I want to go out there and produce that.
Yeah.
You know, when I first met you, Sahadi, and I realized who you were, because I remember the first time I met you, it was on British, or it could have been Wembley, and you walked with me, Noam, and we walked for Wembley, and we had to do some sort of signing, but then I realized who you were. I was like, you're the guy that made, like, the My Way video, the WrestleMania 17 video package. You're the guy. And I couldn't believe that I popped so much, because that is like, whenever I have a couple of drinks and if I ever want anything to uplift me, I will always watch the WrestleMania 17 build-up package to The Rock and Stone Cold. Tell me about that video. Come on. That is the single best. That must be, have the most highest hits, highest views. That, for me, is just spine-tingling amazingness.
Well, there's not much to say about that. You have The Rock and you have Stone Cold and you have a good song. So, I mean, that basically was a very simple one, if you ask me. That didn't require much thought. It was already there. You had all the materials, you know, for the chef to cook, you know, a great soup. I just had to, like, you know, cook the soup. But the ingredients are already there.
This is the thing, David. Like, see when you work, it's like I say that I work in the telly game, and sometimes you work in some TV shows and then you just feel... you've got a certain cast assembled, or there's a certain cast there, and there's just a kind of magic that happens. And then there's other times where you get, where it feels like hard work. It feels like hard work. You know, the sparks only flying on screen, so you're really having to do a lot of work to make things work yourself. You're having to save a lot of stuff in the edit. Did you feel that when you were making your videos and when you're producing your spots back then, that you'd really been blessed with an awful lot of incredibly talented people?
Yes, I would say so. But also there are times when, you know, things don't go the way you plan.
Yeah.
You make magic out of something. And I'll give you an example. This is back in 1996 when Stone Cold was just starting his ascension. And he was having a feud with Bret Hart. And I was tasked with another very creative guy, Chris Chambers, to do some vignettes with Stone Cold Steve Austin in an empty warehouse in Connecticut late at night. Yes, you remember those spots, don't you?
I love this. Yeah.
You're going to like the story, and not to bury Steve, because he's an incredible talent, but Chris and I thought that he was so good that we didn't write anything for him. We just figured we'd turn the cameras on and just let him go. And we did that. And we weren't that happy with what was coming out. Steve was cutting more of a traditional promo that he might cut in the ring. You know, we felt like it wasn't working out, Chris and I. So we said, Steve, time out. And Chris and I went to the side, and Chris and I decided, hey, let's just write these one-liners, you know, Bret Hart, and have him say it three times. Pink tights and sparklers, pink tights and sparklers. What a load of shit. So we basically went from scratch on the spot. We took all these one-liners that we wrote in about 20 minutes. We told them, we gave them to Steve to say, hey, say this line, you know, three times in a row. And we'd go in the editor and pick which takes that we liked, and we'd overlay this video on top of, you know, of what he was saying. Sometimes we'd just look on camera, sometimes these side things. Again, we did not plan this going into the shoot, but we knew that we weren't getting what we wanted to. So it's an act of desperation.
Yeah, right.
We put some barking dogs in the spot as well, too, that we have in video games, some German Shepherds. Steve comes in there and he looks at that spot and he's like, oh my God, geez, you guys are geniuses. I can't believe that. And I don't remember those dogs being there, man. Those barking dogs are great. I don't remember them being there. And it's like, well, that's because they weren't there. We were just trying to, like, make something out of nothing. And that's a thing where I think Chris's idea, you know, along with our editing, to overlap things and do what we did there on the fly. Just, we made something really special that was...
Exactly. You know, I love that. I love that spot, and I talk about it all the time. And I didn't realize you were behind that one as well. I'm pretty sure that it's the one where Stone Cold says as well, you remind me of a piece of trash. And yes. I always talk about this. I always talk about, because the amount of times I've thought about that line, you remind me of a piece of trash, and I always try and think about the logic of it. So he's not saying that he is a piece of trash. He's saying, you remind me of a piece of trash. And then I try and think about, what particular piece of trash does he mean when he's saying that? It's just a beautiful, it's almost surreal. It has a kind of surreal, dreamlike quality at that spot, which... And it makes sense. It makes complete sense now when you explain that, you know, you were really making something out of something that didn't quite pan out how you expected. Amazing, amazing stuff. David, as a producer, how do you feel about the WWE's current attempts to to make the show continue to fly in the empty arena situation and stuff like that? Have you
Impact
been
are doing the same?
Impact well, are doing the same, but WWE have taken a strange approach. How do you feel? How do you, because obviously they're the big promotion who have always had the massive crowds.
Keep it down.
They've had the massive crowds. They've had the massive productions. How do you think they're coping with this situation that they're in?
I think both WWE and AEW are hurting big time right now because they're used to the big crowds and the talent interacting with the crowds.
Yeah.
I think that, and I don't mean to say this in a bad way, Impact, because Impact is really on an ascension, I think, right now with what we're doing, but they have come down to a level by not being able to do things in front of the crowds. They look small right now, if you ask me. I think that our empty arena look that we currently have right now looks better than AEW's. Mm. Raw has a big budget, so theirs looks pretty amazing. I was told that last Friday they took the chairs out of their SmackDown tapings. I'm not sure if that's correct or not, but like up until last week, they were showing you all those empty seats,
yeah.
Whereas we didn't show empty seats. And why are you showing empty seats? You're reminding viewers that people are not there.
Yeah.
And they're not there because this pandemic is happening. You want people to like forget about that right away. You're turning to entertainment to take your mind off the sadness and tragedy that's going on in the world. So when we did our empty arena look, we had no seats there. And we had a really cool screen and some good lighting. I just got off the phone with our lighting guy, Dan Rial. That's why I'm a little late for this podcast, because we were talking of ways that we can enhance it when we do our next set of tapings in a couple of weeks. And I'm really excited about the way we look right now. It's almost like they've fallen down to our level. And if you were a non-wrestling fan and you didn't know the difference between the mega superstars
yep.
and our superstars, you would say, hey, you know what? These three are all the same. They're on the same level. You know, it's like one shouldn't cost more than the other.
Yeah.
And their budgets are so extreme with what their overhead is so extreme for both those companies. And they're not getting the revenue they normally get, where our overhead is way small. We can thrive and survive in this kind of era. We can actually kick their butts, I think, creatively going forward in this era right now, just because they have come down to our level by not being able to be in those massive arenas that they're used to being in.
David, do you feel quite creatively inspired by the challenge of this as well?
Yes, I do. Always looking at ways to improve things and do things better. That's why I just got the phone call with the lighting guy and how we can enhance our look going forward. But yeah, I mean, just being with this company right now, working with Eric Tompkins, who's such a creative guy, it's just, you know, he's inspiring me a lot. I'm inspiring him a lot. We haven't even scratched the surface of what we can do just yet. And it's very exciting to know that what we're doing right now, even when we do come back to having crowds in arenas, hopefully sooner than later, that we might be discovering some new things now that we will apply to and use going forward and say, oh yeah, we sorted that kind of style back when we had empty arenas because we were forced to, but guess what? That's kind of a cool thing. So there are things that we haven't even uncovered yet that I think we'll be using in our toolbox 5, 10, 20 years down the road.
Yeah, because there's a few things I noticed that I liked, and when I watched WrestleMania, when they went ahead with WrestleMania, which I think everybody was, you know, maybe you would have been less shocked by it, David, because you know Vince, you've known Vince,
yes.
But I think a lot of people were shocked by it. But there were certain things in that I found really interesting, like being able to hear the wrestlers talk to each other. The fact there was actually dialogue within matches was something that, you know, you're not used to hearing. What you're used to in a wrestling match, how it's normally produced, is you don't hear what the wrestlers are saying. You don't want to hear them calling any spots or anything like that. So it was interesting to hear moments of conversation between the wrestlers. And I think I would miss it. I think I would miss that being a creative option going forward. So there might be new angles on things, I think.
No, absolutely. And getting to the point that you just said, one thing that I learned from our last tapings is that there are some matches where the wrestlers were doing a lot of talking and trash talking during the match.
Yeah.
Or sometimes when you had Johnny Swinger outside the ring, who was saying a lot of funny stuff, he was cheering on, you know, his guy that was in the ring wrestling. I want the talent to do more of that next time we do our tapings in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
I want to hear the referees more. Referees are there to enforce rules. I want to hear them yelling, you got to separate, you got to do this, you got to do that. I don't think we heard the referees talk enough and enforce the rules enough in our last set of tapings. They will be doing that going forward. So as you said, yeah, those conversations are interesting. The trash talking is interesting because there is storytelling in that as well.
Was there ever any moments, David, when you worked for WWF when Vince was pissed off at you or was unhappy at your work where you had to restart everything and no, do it again? Was there any, did that ever happen at your time there?
Oh, Grado. not that he was pissed off, but the spot you mentioned in the office of Titan Towers, a corporate headquarters that aired in the Super Bowl. Yeah. Well, for the sequel, the next year, we had a spot lined up at Rodney Dangerfield. And it was a very, very, I think, entertaining spot that never got shot. Mm. We had a Hollywood soundstage that they shot a very famous movie on. We had the set designer from the movie Armageddon, who was doing all of these special effects for us. We basically built Roddy Dangerfield's mansion that Vince's wrestlers were going to, you know, take by storm and destroy. We were going to kill Roddy Dangerfield.
Oh my God.
It was 2 days before the shoot. And I got a call from Kevin Dunn that Vince wanted the shot canceled because he wanted to go in a different direction. And I'm just like, Kevin, it's 2 days away. We've been working on this for weeks. I said, we're going to owe, 90% of the budget. It's already spent. And yeah. Kevin's like, Vince doesn't care. He wants to do something different. Because one of the wrestlers got in his head. I think, I won't mention a name, but I think one of the wrestlers didn't feel he or she was featured enough in the spots. And didn't like it because of that and got in Vince's head right before the shoot and talked him out of it.
Not that
Vince is mad, but that really crushed my heart. That was just like, we are on the precipice of doing something really creative, really good that people would talk about.
As well.
What's that?
And it's different and it appeals again to that audience that have never seen wrestling. If they saw that, they're never going to skip the channel. They're never going to skip the channel if they see that.
No, of course not.
David, what wrestlers have you found the most inventive and, just the quickest and easiest to work with? I don't mean easiest to work with just because they'll do what they're told very easily, but what wrestlers have you found had the best ideas and were on your wavelength?
God, there are so many. I can't begin to mention names. I'm going to upset some people. I'll just mention one to start with, and you guys can ask me about some others, but The Undertaker was great to work with.
Right.
Because every shoot we did was at night. It was in a warehouse somewhere in Connecticut, in an abandoned warehouse. And I'd call him up and say, hey, Mark, you got to shoot this Thursday. He goes, I know. Sunset to sunrise. I just say, yep. And I'd say, we got a trailer for you. We have a PA to get you food. He goes, no, I don't need anything. I said, well, what do you need? He goes, a case of Coors Light and a bottle of Jack Daniels.
There you go.
And he was just hanging on his trailer. He was the easiest. I guess I'm not answering your question. He was my most favorite guy to work with because he was so low maintenance. So
yeah,
on his trailer. Knocking on his door, he said every 2 minutes, 2 minutes before we need him, come knock on the door. We're knocking the door. Sure enough, he'd be there right on set, hands up, rest in peace. Boom, explosion behind him. He'd look at at me and said, how was that, David? And I said, good. And he goes, help me for the next take. I'm like, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. He goes, just come knock on my trailer. And he never once complained. Never once complained. I worked with him about 20 different times, never once complained.
Excellent. Did you catch the Boneyard match at WrestleMania? Did you catch his
match? You know what? I did not watch WrestleMania this year, and I don't watch. I have to admit this. I'm going to piss a lot of people off, but I don't watch much of Raw at all anymore.
It would be interesting for you to take a look at the Boneyard match because I think
JB had a bit of involvement in that.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
No, but is that the one with Taker and AJ Styles?
Yeah,
I heard that was
in that.
Well, yeah, I do want to see that because Eric's been doing stuff like that, not on that scale or that budget for the past year, especially with the Undead Realm. So I do want to see that because I heard it was amazing. But going back to one reason why I didn't watch WrestleMania, why I haven't watched wrestling that much is I think that there needs to be a paradigm shift in the way the product is presented. Because when I left there in 2003, it's still pretty much the same formula. You open up with an in-ring promo. Somebody cuts it off. It sets up a match for later on that night. Then you have some filler matches. I think the format needs to be completely changed. And the genre needs to be presented in a whole new way. That's what we did in the Attitude Era. We presented everything in a whole completely different way. From the way we presented our talent to the collaboration with the musicians and the songs to the staging, the screens, the setups, everything, taking the cameras backstage and shooting real stuff that was happening backstage. A lot of times you went backstage back then, if you notice, you'd see talent that was out of character because they didn't know we were going backstage. We just said, hey, let's just do that. Yeah. And now when you go backstage, it's so choreographed and so staged and so fake that it feels blah. But they've been doing the same formula for 20-some years. They need to change that. And that's one reason why I've lost interest in the genre. it needs another paradigm shift in the way it's
presented.
But as a inside the ring, but everything else that happens to the point of them getting into the ring.
Yeah, but as a production issue, I mean, this is the thing, it is absolutely a production issue, I think, because when people talk about, you hear people talking a lot about how the Attitude Era was cool, how the wrestlers were cool back then.
Yes.
How the stories were cooler back then. And I think actually, in truth, the show was cool. It was the show that was cool. It was Raw that was cool. It was the show. It wasn't so much the wrestlers. It was how the show felt. It was the pyro at the start. It was the
packages. Because a lot of it was real. It wasn't as scripted as it is right now. Right now, it's overproduced and overwritten. Back then, you'd give talent bullet points to go out there to cut a promo. Just bullet points.
Now
we have a page and a half long script that they got to remember and memorize. And when you do that, as an audience member, you feel as though they're, you know, trying to remember something that they're supposed to say, as opposed to it really coming from the heart, what they are saying. A lot of stuff was more real back then than it is right now. I think everything, again, is too overproduced and overscripted and micromanaged. I mean, back in the 90s, we went from the cartoony characters of the 80s to making them feel real. You know, characters like Stone Cold Steve Austin doing things that everybody wants to do. Everybody who works for somebody else wants to be able to give the finger to their boss and tell them to fuck off and still not get fired, still have their job.
Right.
It doesn't feel quite as real anymore. And I don't know if that's good or bad, but you know, I think judging by what the numbers are showing you, it's not a good thing. I think when things feel real, that's when you get the audience. Like, I remember when the whole Stone Cold phenomenon was happening, I would go across the country and people would be like, "Oh, you work for WWE?" "Yes, I do." "I know wrestling is fake, but Stone Cold and Vince, they really hate each other, don't they?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, they really do." And that's when you know, oh, you had them hooked. I think we need more of that. We need to make things feel real again.
All right. What made you leave WWE?
To be honest, it was getting boring working there. What happened, Grado, was, you know, the company becomes so big. When we started the, and I'm just going to say the term again, Attitude Era, but basically when we were on the bottom and then rising up, it's like there were a handful of us that did that, that were part of that we built that. We felt proud of that. A handful of people, I would say, myself being one of the five. And then we became so successful and it went corporates, you know, then it went public. All these outsiders were coming in, all these big time executives from elsewhere that were telling us, you know, that they know better what to do, how to make things, you know, better. And it became too structured for me. It became too corporate. It became too sanitized. So it wasn't as fun to work there anymore. Instead of me just going out and doing a spot on my own, like the Legend spot with Gorilla Monsoon and Freddie Blass that you all mentioned earlier, I had to run my scripts by layers and layers of people. And it just, everything just got watered down. And it was not a fun place to be anymore. I couldn't be creative. So I just decided to leave.
And did TNA approach you, or did they realize?
I took a year and a half off. And right. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I traveled cross country, sold my house, wrote a book, and Jeff Jarrett contacted me and said, "Hey, David, I heard you haven't been in TV for a while." I said, "Nope." He goes, "I heard you're going cross country a lot too." I said, "Yep." He goes, "Have you been in Nashville?" And I said, "No." He goes, "Well, you know what? Make that a mark on your stop. Why don't you come on by? I'd love you to work with me." And I came there, and you know, between Jeff and his father, Jerry, who I really connected with Jerry Jarrett, we became very close. I decided to join Impact for 3 months to get them to the monthly pay-per-views in 2004. They were switching from that weekly Wednesday model to the Fox Sports Net model and then to the monthly pay-per-view model. So I was there to help launch Victory Road. And there were so many characters that I really – I saw the passion on the talent that worked there behind the scenes and the wrestlers as well. I saw people like Abyss and Chris Daniels and Frankie Kazarian and Coach D'Amore, now my boss, and how much they care and what great people they were. And I'm just like, my B game for them is like better than anything they've ever had before, because they didn't have any kind of budget. So I didn't want to leave these people after my 3 months. So I kind of like felt like was a small, you know, but growing new family. And that's what made me stay. And I've stayed through the highs and the lows.
Because I always remember I remember watching TNA, and I remember the image of the satellite. You know what I'm talking about? Open to that TNA.
And this is TNA.
Aye,
face professional wrestling. Boom. Yes, and the voice of God, Barry Scott, who sounded like voice James Earl Jones. Yes.
Brilliant. I'm sure he done one voice. He said my name once, and I nearly came in my pants when he. And he mentioned next week Grado is going to be on Impact. And I was like, oh my God, yes!
Hey, if we can re-sign you, wait to see the packages that Eric and I will do for you. We'll do some great stuff if we can get you signed.
Well, I've been talking to Eric back and forth. It could be coming. Scott DeMore, if you're listening, Scott.
Well, listen,
I'll pass on the good word to Scott. I think when it comes to talent, he values Eric's opinion more than mine, but I'll definitely talk to Scott about that.
David, thanks so much for coming on the show. Will you come back and speak to us another time? Because we'd love to catch up with you, see how Impact's going. And
I would love to come back again. Thank you for having me. This is my first podcast ever. So, you popped my cherry. I hope I didn't let you guys down.
No, you did. You did great. And honestly, having somebody, I just want to say, genuinely want to say a personal thank you to you for you gave me some great moments when I was younger watching WWF. So thanks for that. You definitely made me feel the emotion that you were looking for there. So thanks so much for that, David.
That means a lot to me. Thank you so much for saying that. That really does.
I'm very much similar myself. So many memories have been created through your work. And it was always a pleasure to work with you, David, and get a few beers after the show and stuff like that. So hopefully I'll see you somewhere down the road. Hopefully, fingers crossed, because you're a great guy. And I'm sure this will be the start of your podcast career, where you'll be on fucking everybody's podcast.
Yeah, everybody's. Thanks so much, David. Stay safe.
We'll do. You guys stay safe as well, please.
Stay safe.
We'll talk soon. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, sorry again if I'm sorry. I don't know. I mean, you say to me now and again, you know, Grado's turning heel and all this. You know, I like to come on here. I think I've loosened up a wee bit.
No, you've been a good laugh tonight, mate.
Think so.
You've been good form tonight.
You were in good form with Sahadi, mate. You know all that producing shit. You're always doing that comedy. You know that carry on fucking that Microsoft Paint and Adobe Photoshop and all that shit.
I love talking to that guy. I think that's one of our best interviews we've done, mate. Because I think what an incredible guest to have. That's an incredible guest you sourced for us there, Grado.
Thanks very much,
man. You sourced that, and I might have a go at you and rib you about going on about TNA all the time and all that, but you made some connections there, mate, that
admit
you'll never lose any connections.
That's
mate.
What I'm saying. That was one of the biggest things that I took away from TNA was being muckled up with these kind of guys. Him and Keith Mitchell, you always see Keith Mitchell getting brought up. You know, listen to his stories. We used to go to a play. There's a place in Orlando. In fact, it was anywhere we'd done a show. After the show, we'd find a wee bit of the hotel outside, build a fire and call it the Red River Saloon. And it would just be all the old producers and editors sitting, telling their stories, smoking their hash. And I used to fucking love it, man. And I used to get them to... And obviously, I added a wee bit of colour to it. I'd come in and go, who owns a gun? What the fuck you get guns for? You know, someone comes in my house and all this fucking shit. I got to get all fucking loonies. You're all fucking loonies. You know, you dumb Scottish fuck. What the fuck are you even doing here anyway, man? But I remember fucking Errol Hemner one time saying to me at it, and it really broke my heart. He went, why the fuck are they booking you? You draw no fucking money. I know what your flat costs. I know how much you earn. How much you making this fucking company? I was like, I'm away in my bed before I punch fuck you. You got the point?
Well.
You got the point?
It's a circus. It's everybody's playing their part. But it speaks a lot. Listen, I'll say something, Grado, right? It says a lot for you as a person that you're asking some of these guys that you've met over the years and stuff like that, where you come on the show and have a chat with you and stuff like that, and they're always really happy to come on, and they're always really happy to talk to you. So it says a lot about the impression you made upon them when you were there. So that's something you can go to bed happy thinking about, the fact that all these guys are always very keen to talk to you and always very keen to catch up with you. So you've been doing something right, mate.
Fuck, that's such a good emotional point, mate. That's brilliant.
No, you're welcome, mate.
But I still hope we beat you at the RTS Awards.
Play. Wouldn't they want it any other way, mate? Wouldn't they want it any other way?
Anyway, mate, I hope we should sit next to each other.
Mate, there's the fucking awards on their own.
Oh, fuck's sake.
I forgot. It was meant to be in June, mate. It's meant to be next month. It's cancelled.
What's the point
even nominating us, I know? Yeah.
I don't want to win. That's the winning listener of the week on this. It's fucking nothing.
It's like Grado. It's like selling winning this league.
Hi, guys. Thanks for listening to Wrestling Daft.
Good night, everybody. Up the road.
Next week, it's yourself.
It's yourself. Up the road.
11. 11.
Up your road.
11. Audio Frontier.